The next case is Lynn Ann Martin versus Philip Martin. Craig Hugach is here for Lynn Ann Martin. Alan Craig is here for Philip Martin. And Mr. Hugach, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Craig Hugach on behalf of the appellant. In this case, it involves a state court property division in a divorce and a monetary equitable distribution judgment, which attempts to vest the property owned by the debtor to the non-debtor ex-spouse post-petition. And it's important to recognize the timeline of the petition because one of the undisputed principles of law in this case is that if a bankruptcy is filed before a judgment was rendered on a claim for equitable distribution or property division, then that claim of the non-debtor spouse becomes a claim against the estate. In fact, in most cases, a dischargeable claim against the estate. And the title of those assets don't vest as they would if the judgment were rendered before the petition.
We understand the bench trial was done. The judge announced her rulings. 18 days later, the bankruptcy petition's filed and the judgment's entered. That's the timeline, right?
Correct.
And under the law, though, it's a ministerial act entering the judgment. Okay, so, and I know you got that Second Circuit case, but it's not important. Why is that not in effect? It was a vesting at the time. It was a litigated case, bench trial, I guess, or jury trial in the state court, bench trial. The judge did all her findings of fact, right?
Correct.
Your client knew she'd lost.
That's right.
Okay. And before the judge could get the judgment, which is just really a ministerial act in, your client filed bankruptcy. Is that the timeline?
That is correct.
Okay. So why isn't that a vesting?
Well, the issue of whether or not the judgment was entered after the ruling and whether it's a ministerial act really isn't a relevant analysis under the case law. The law related to the judgment, including a number of the cases cited in the briefs, do occur after ruling. The legal effect of that divorce judgment is when the property vests and when title vests. So if the bankruptcy is filed before that date, then the fact that there still needs to be another act to enter the judgment after, regardless of the amount of judicial labor that would be required to do that, the automatic stay still comes into effect and prevents the vesting. So in this case, the bankruptcy judge's ruling wasn't based on the notion that there was only one more act to do to enter the judgment. The issue on appeal is whether or not the automatic stay applied to these claims at the time of the petition. So the bankruptcy judge in this case said in his ruling that the automatic stay didn't apply. And therefore, when the judgment was entered post-petition, it became effect and they were allowed to enforce that judgment. That's why the timeline is so important here, because the judgment was not entered after this stay order. The judgment was actually entered prior to that, based on the bankruptcy court's initial order. We've called it the interim order. And the timeline was after the filing of the petition, the bankruptcy court entered another order. This is in October.
Counsel, thank you.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
So let me ask you, though, under 541C2, why is that not an adequate basis to affirm the district court's judgment here? I mean, it seems the proceeds from this would be excluded under New York law. Under 541C2?
It's two reasons. The first is that under 1306, because this is a Chapter 13, 1306 of the Bankruptcy Code says, in addition to those things under 541, post-petition income of the debtor is in fact property of the estate. And in this case, in fact, that is the income that is funding the plan. So in a Chapter 13 case, the debtor is required to contribute those assets. And in our brief, we actually cite cases that relate specifically to pensions and specifically to the exclusion property. So while the corpus of the trust. I'm sorry, you're muted, Your Honor.
Sorry. Thanks for the reminder. But let me ask you a question about that, because, you know, I am aware of the Regan case, but it seems like that doesn't really prevail anymore, and that that the Supreme Court rejected Regan's narrow reading of 541c2 in Patterson, and it clarified that that section doesn't just apply to spendthrift trusts, and that it applies to other things as well.
I agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay.
The issue here is the augmentation of 1306 of 541. So what happens is the corpus of the trust is accepted from the automatic stay, but the income and the distributions that were attached are property of the estate. The Diebold case that we cited in our brief really deals with this head on. It's that the property which was excluded becomes property of the estate in the Chapter 13 or in a Chapter 11 because it's post-petition income, as opposed to the corpus.
I'm sorry, isn't the Diebold case under Ohio law? I mean, we're talking about New York law here, and New York courts have held that pension protections in the New York Retirement and Social Security Law, Section 110, which is very, very similar to the New York education law that we're talking about, quote, shields a retirement allowance from creditors, both while the funds are in the possession and control of the retirement system and after distribution to retirees.
Your Honor, what I can tell you is that in the connection with the Chapter 13s and the Chapter 11s in at least this district, this circuit, the debtor, including in this case, is required to put that pension income into the plan as property of the estate. I have not seen any case where the debtor was permitted to retain the proceeds of their pension income or even income like an IRA or a 401k and exclude them from the property of the bankruptcy case. I don't have a case site for you on that, but in this case, under these facts, the debtor's income is in fact in the Chapter 13 plan. It is the only income that is funding the plan. And so whether by voluntary inclusion or by operation of law, this income is property of the estate subject to creditors, and the creditors that participate in the case are deriving income from the disposable income of the debtor under that issue.
To interrupt again, and I understand what you're saying. It certainly makes sense from a certain point of view. After all, that's the income that is supposed to be funding the plan. But the case law on this and the reason for the protection that New York has issued is to protect the third party beneficiaries of the trusts, right? From actions of the debtor. And so here the third party beneficiary, I guess, would be the husband. And so, I mean, that reasoning would go to the same thing, right? Protect him from the actions of the debtor here, the wife. Why is that not the case?
Well, because I don't think that the husband isn't the third party beneficiary here for purposes of the equitable distribution claim. What the husband here is claiming is an ownership interest. He's claiming the 50% or the New York spousal share of the income. But what he's also claiming is to take his equitable distribution claim as a creditor and attach it to the income. So there's really two separate things that the state court did, and they should be treated a little bit differently. One is the division of property, which I think is what Your Honor was getting at. But the second thing the New York court was permitted to do was take the monetary judgment and attach that property and secure that creditor claim, which would normally be a dischargeable creditor claim. And that would participate with other creditors in the case. If I could address the other issue, which maybe I should have started
before
with
you do on 541. Before you do that, I have a question. Is her bankruptcy still ongoing?
It's ongoing in the sense that the plan has been confirmed and is being funded from the pension. There's not a disputed bankruptcy.
Okay, and in you said that earlier, the plan is being funded. You mean by her portion of the pension?
That's correct. His portion of the pension has been removed.
Tell me a little bit about that. it goes into her income. As I was reading the New York law, are they actually paying the creditor some of the money out of her pension? Because it looks like New York protects that.
In this case, Your Honor, the pension is funding income of the debtor, and then she has, I would like to use some of my rebuttal time for initial argument, if that would be acceptable.
You can answer Judge Hall's question, Mr. Bugatch.
Yeah, you're going on about, how the money is being used to pay her creditors in the bankruptcy. You brought that up. And so, what does she get a month in the pension? And is that actually going to pay off her student loans, or is she, under the plan, getting it to live on?
It's both, Your Honor. So what happens is the pension income is delivered to her, as would other income, a job or otherwise. And then the payments that were calculated under the Chapter 13, she has to fund the plan. So it's a disposable income calculation that she's making the payments to creditors. So she is living off that money.
So is she really, because she's had to share a pension, does she have any disposable income left to pay any creditors?
There is small amounts of disposable income that go to fund the plan, yes. I don't want to misspeak, Your Honor. They're less than $2,500 are the plan payments that were going to creditors, but I don't remember the specific plan payments, and I don't want to misspeak.
Okay.
Go ahead, Judge.
Because, see, what would happen is if what you say is true, and the other spouse could run up debts and defeat the marital award by filing bankruptcy and get the other one's money in the bankruptcy estate to pay off her debts.
Well, that's true, except for the fact that the ex-spouse would also be a creditor in the bankruptcy and would participate in those distributions as well. So
he'd be a creditor with pro rata creditor. He wouldn't have a priority. He'd be a pro rata creditor. She has $150,000 in debt. He would have a creditor claim, but he would only participate pro rata with everybody else, right?
That's exactly what the statutory scheme envisions. Equitable distribution claims are pro rata.
That's the question in the case, is that's what it envisions. You keep saying, he's a creditor. He would just share pro rata, is what you're saying, with her other creditors, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you for the indulgence, Judge Wilson. He can go on and make his argument if he wants to.
I have just one more question. Is my understanding incorrect that bankruptcy judges always have the discretion to lift an automatic stay for cause if the debtor has acted in bad faith?
That's a true principle, Your Honor. I don't think that's what the principle of the court ruled here, but that is a correct statement.
Well, this was Judge Olson took note of the fact that the petition was filed in the last hours prior to the entry of a final judgment in a divorce case initiated in October 2015, when the decision after bench trial had already been rendered. He determined that the state court found Philip credible and your client to be significantly lacking in credibility. Her lawyer was hit with $25,000 in attorney's fees. That's not enough to support a determination that she acted in bad faith and that the automatic stay could be lifted for cause?
Well, had he ruled that way, I would say that's the case. But the issue that he ruled upon here, and what his ruling was, and I'm looking at the order itself, was that he says the automatic stay nor any provision of the bankruptcy code prohibits the state court from entering the order, and that the automatic stay did not apply. the ruling here and the arguments that have been made are that an exception to the stay renders it inapplicable and thus pulls it out of the realm of what would be stayed under 362A.
All right, thank you. We'll hear from Mr. Crane.
I'm sorry, I'm gonna ask you this. Just assume we can affirm for any reason. I don't know if his order is that narrow or not, but if the bankruptcy court had done that and say it's not subject, then what would be the result here?
Had the bankruptcy court determined that for cause, the stay should be lifted?
Yeah.
The standard would be different, and we would be talking about both an abuse of discretion standard or clearly erroneous if there were fact finding, as opposed to what I believe is a de novo review of whether the stay applies at the time the judgment was entered.
But I got that. But if he found that it was bad faith and the automatic stay should be lifted, and let's assume there's no error in that, and the district court affirms that, and we were to affirm that too. I'm just walking down that scenario. What then would be the effect? Would the spouse have the pension? It wouldn't be subject to bankruptcy?
Yes, the judgment then could have been entered post relief from stay and vested the pension.
All right.
Well, before you conclude, I'm looking at the bankruptcy judge's order. I'm going to read from it. Page 5 of the bankruptcy judge's order. Judge Olson says, quote, the court views as offensive to good faith and the orderly administration of justice the filing of a petition at the latest of hours prior to the entry of a final judgment in a divorce case initiated in October 2015 when a decision after bench trial had already been rendered. This court will not impose the provisions of the automatic stay to apply to a state court divorce case that has already been fully decided, but for the ministerial act of entry of a final judgment that merely implements the decision after bench trial. That's not enough of a finding of bad faith.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I would disagree that that's the finding of bad faith. I don't think that's enough for a finding of bad faith. Had the court found bad faith, what he would have done was for cause lifted the stay, as opposed to rendering an opinion based on the arguments of counsel that it legally didn't apply in the first instance. I think that those findings go to a lot of it goes to paragraph 2 of the ruling, which was, he answered a show cause as to the good faith nature of the bankruptcy case generally and whether the other creditors should be treated in the plan. And ultimately, a plan was confirmed and the case was not dismissed on bad faith or abstained from.
All right, thank you. We'll hear from Mr. Crane.
Thank you.
If it may please the court, my name is Alan Crane. I represent Philip Martin, who requests that this court affirm the district court's affirmance of the bankruptcy court orders. This case really is the poster child of a bad faith filing of a losing spouse who files a bankruptcy just to frustrate the divorce decree. The judge did lift the automatic stay. We asked for the automatic stay to be lifted as alternative grounds. We asked that the court find that it not be in place. The judge granted 4 types of relief for us. On the bad faith aspect that you were talking about, I want to point out the transcript that we put into our appendix, the supplemental appendix, where the lawyer for Ms. Martin came into court and said, it was a magical day. The day I filed, and I filed that day before the final judgment was entered, because I think that makes a difference about the dischargeability of the claim. The sole purpose of this bankruptcy was to defeat my client's ownership interest in the pension. So when he talks about income coming out and paying the plan, it is the income of that remains, not my client's income from the pension, but the undivided, or the portion that still remains with the appellant. As the court pointed out, there was a finding of bad faith. And yes, a petition filed in bad faith for the sole purpose of frustrating a divorce decree is sufficient for there to be finding of cause. Also, the bankruptcy court abstained in the February of 2019 order from hearing any matters related to the state court proceeding. Under 28 U.S.C. 1334D, this court, nor the Supreme Court, nor any other court has any jurisdiction to reverse that order. That issue was not briefed by the appellants. The district court noted that that issue was not briefed by the appellants in the district court case. They don't mention it here, but you don't have jurisdiction. The bankruptcy court, even if you were to reverse this case, for whatever grounds, the bankruptcy court no longer has jurisdiction over any part of the state court proceeding because he abstained, and it's not something that can be, it's not subject to review. The bankruptcy court did grant stay relief. Counsel keeps in the brief and says that the only ground was that the judge found that the stay was not applicable. Well, we asked for that, but we also very specifically asked for a finding that to the extent that the stay was applicable, that stay relief be granted. And the court granted that. In both the October 2018 order preliminarily, and then further in the February of 2019 order. In the February 2019 order, the court said the creditor has relief from the automatic stay to enforce the final judgment. And it in post that order being entered, the state court was specifically in the February order allowed to issue the qualified domestic relations order, which now divides the interest of the pension so that my client is receiving the income for his ownership interest.
But counsel, I'm sorry, yeah. In fairness though, when the final judgment had not yet been entered, I'm not sure you can really say it was a ministerial act because they were still trying to work out exactly the details of how the 20, what ultimately wound up being the 20%, how that would be paid and things of that nature. And the state court had left open a few issues in that respect and had left it to the parties to work it out. So I'm a little troubled by the notion that it was just a ministerial act at that point. I don't know if you might want to address that.
I will. I don't think you actually even have to get there because of the stay relief issue, and the stay was granted. But as to the on separate grounds, it was granted based upon cause, and this court can affirm on any grounds. But that was one of the alternative reliefs. It was one ministerial act away. There was nobody else that could actually intercede as to the division of the pension. The judge, and it's in the exhibits, the state court judge issued a letter, said basically, I'm fed up with you guys from arguing all of this and submit your documents or complaints in a motion form, but here's how I'm going to rule on it. And in that letter, she says to both counsel that you can send me whatever you want, but here's my initial impression about how I'm going to rule on these things. There may have been a couple of little tweaks and whatever that need to be made, but I don't believe if you look at the final judgment.
Yeah, but I mean, and I understand, but I don't think we can, looking at the final judgment, I don't think we can retrospectively determine that it was a ministerial act to enter it. I mean, I think we have to look at it from the point in time before it was entered to see whether it was a foregone conclusion that it would be entered in the form that I guess it ultimately was entered, or they anticipated it might be entered. And here it seems like that, you know, there was still some room for bargaining. It was still not a done deal completely. And when we talk about a ministerial act, we're usually talking about something where there's no judgment involved and you just enter it. But that's not what happened here, as a matter of fact. It doesn't seem like to me. Maybe I'm misunderstanding the record.
So New York does things differently. And so in a case in Florida, you would have a final judgment that's entered. You won't have a decision order, but you'll have a final judgment that's entered, and then you'll have motions for reconsideration attacking that. Apparently what they do in New York is the opposite. There's a decision after bench trial that's entered, and then the parties will file their motions for reconsideration or asking for different changes to be made. The judge rules on those. And if I remember correctly, the judge didn't make any changes or anything of any significance. And so the fundamental ruling of the bankruptcy of the state court was the same in the final judgment. And actually, in the final judgment, she incorporated the entire decision after bench trial. So the final judgment may have tweaked something, but the entire decision after bench trial was incorporated into the final judgment.
Okay, let's assume Judge Rosenbaum's correct in that regard. Can you walk me through how you affirm based on the relief from the automatic stay? Okay, tell me the bankruptcy law. So you get a relief from the automatic stay.
And yes.
And because for cause, let's assume for sake of the argument, what Judge Wilson says is enough to show that there was a relief from the automatic stay. And then what is the effect of that on the bankruptcy court?
So
your judgment does become final and you got relief from the stay. Does that just take the whole thing out of bankruptcy?
Yes.
That takes that judgment out of bankruptcy?
Yes. And if you specifically look at the combination of the abstention, where the bankruptcy judge said, I'm abstaining from hearing any matters pertaining to the state court dissolution proceeding. Okay. And then you add
I'm trying to understand it simply. Okay, we got a bankruptcy. There's a judgment rendered post-petition. We'll accept that. It wasn't final, but it's a final judgment post-petition. And the bankruptcy court has power to say, okay, but for cause and bad faith, I'm going to give relief from the automatic stay. And so does the person who get that judgment no longer have to do anything in bankruptcy?
Correct.
They can execute the judgment.
Yes, and that was what was done on here.
That's a simple way. I mean, that just takes it out.
Yes, the bankruptcy judge in the February of 2019 order, in the two different ways that he did it, which is abstention, which means he no longer has jurisdiction, coupled with the stay relief that he granted. And as I said, the creditor has relief from the automatic stay to enforce the judgment, takes it completely out of the bankruptcy. And this court doesn't really even have the ability to, we've argued that this appeal is moot, because no matter what you do, you can't order the bankruptcy court would not have the ability on a reversal for whatever grounds you might reverse. And I don't understand what those would be, but the hypothetically, if it was reversed, the bankruptcy court no longer has jurisdiction over anything to do with the state court divorce proceeding. And so therefore—
And your client's been actually getting this money all these years. I mean,
yes, and there was no stay pending appeal. And by the way, the argument also that the stay, you know, the granting of a stay is abuse of discretion. That's not an issue that was even addressed by the appellant. And so I would argue that that was waived. So it was moot. I think that this case is moot because there's no effective relief that this court can grant. Stay relief was in fact granted.
Counsel, if there were just abstention, you would agree that it wouldn't be moot, right? Because 1334D says subsection C in this subsection shall not be construed to limit the applicability of the stay provided for by section 362 of Title 11 U.S. Code, right?
Correct. But it's the combination, right? The judge didn't just abstain and he didn't just grant stay relief. He did both.
If we found that this was moot, I don't see how we could find that this is moot. And I'll tell you why, because if we did, then we would never be able to review any actions or lack of actions with respect to 1334D's second clause, right? I mean, if just the mere abstention took it out of our bailiwick, right? And we couldn't review it at all, then how would we be able to enforce or make sure that the second clause of 1334D was enforced? And if we, you know, and in order to do that, we have to review it. So how is it moot? I don't understand.
Because the quadra in the state court proceeding, which was entered at a time that there was no stay, the final judgment was entered, the quadros were issued, the ownership interests were transferred, and the bankruptcy court has no authority whatsoever to order that, I'll quote from their brief, that the egg be unscrambled.
Well, I mean, that makes sense when you're talking about a piece of property, for example, and there are new owners and there are problems in that way. But if there were an issue here, if the stay were incorrectly issued for some reason, if we were to find error with that, why would we not be able to order relief and order that it be returned, the property, the money?
Because there's no court in the federal system that has authority to order the bank or the state court to undo the orders.
But see, that takes us back into the tautology of the absence of the stay, right? I mean, either the issuance of the stay was right, or it was within discretion, or it was wrong, right? One way or the other. And what you're telling me, and what I understand you to be telling the court, is you can't review that. That doesn't make sense to me, because 1334D's second clause says that the subsection shall not be construed to limit the applicability of the stay. So there must be a way to review that. Maybe I'm confused here. You can help me out.
Yes. So certain actions took place at the time that there was no stay. There is no case law cited, and I'm not aware of any, actually I'm aware of to the opposite, that the stay could be retroactively reapplied. So just like in a case where you have a situation where there was a sale of property, and that is something, because there was property that was transferred pursuant to a state court order. And so you can't, because they did not seek a stay pending appeal, all of the state court actions took place. The orders were issued. The quadro was issued. The quadro ordered. You're on mute. I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's a different issue, right? It's, that's a different kind of stay, obviously. And with respect to that kind of stay, again, that gets back to why couldn't we just, if we thought there were an error, why couldn't we order him to pay back the money? Or if we couldn't, why couldn't we order from now going forward that the money is included in the estate? I mean, I don't see how this is moot, but okay. Maybe I'm missing something.
I'll turn and say that I don't think you even have to get to mootness. I think we still win on the issue of that there was no abuse of discretion On the granting of the automatic stay.
And what you're going to find now is the appellant, and I'm just going to give you one last minute because we won't be hearing back from you. I agree it's not moot because at the minimum, at least we could do going forward, what's being paid out going forward. And for a number of reasons, I don't think it's moot, but that he's going to say, look, on appeal, the bankruptcy court did this based on that it was not property of the state, that it vested pre-petition, or at least the district court did. The bankruptcy court never did it on the grounds of, well, we know the district court didn't because the district court just ruled it was not pre, it was vested. And so it didn't come into the estate. But he's going to argue that the there was never a ruling by the bankruptcy court that way. And then that's why he on appeal has not even asked a court to review the discretionary decision to lift the stay, because that's not the what the bankruptcy court did. So just tell me succinctly your best case, what order I'm gonna look at, that you're gonna tell me the bankruptcy court did have enough of a ruling there that we can affirm on that the bankruptcy court did do a lifting of the automatic stay for good cause. Just tell me the orders we should look at.
Please look at the February 2019 order, which is appendix, it's number 6,
okay.
In which the court finds, let me just
scroll. Is that the one Judge Wilson read from?
Yes, and the court says, abstained, and then in its ruling said that it was this creditor has relief from the automatic stay to enforce the final judgment. That's different.
Is there any other order besides that February 2019 we should look at?
There's the October 2018 order that also says that it's granting relief from the automatic stay to the extent that the stay actually applies. So
we- And then he later on did it and said the findings. Okay, I got it. Those are the two orders. Thank you, you've answered my question.
Thank you.
Who got you for reserve some time for rebuttal?
Thank you. I'd like to again go back to the timeline, because I think it's critical based on the arguments and the questions so far to understand that the October order was a lift stay to permit the parties to get divorced. So just like in Florida, you can sever the marriage and then deal with issues of alimony support and distribution separately from that. The October order was not a lift stay related to the property issues. The February order is.
You got to say that again. I'm not understanding what you're saying.
Sure. The purpose of the October order was specifically to permit the parties to go get a divorce, specifically to sever their marriage. It was mostly an agreed order, actually. And what it did was allowed them to go end their marriage bond, but it reserved on the issues of property distribution, equitable distribution, if support were at issue, for example, if there were children, which there were not here, the custody could be at issue. Those issues are separate from the actual act of severing the marriage. So that was the purpose of the October order. And the judge's part of agreed language, the judge specifically reserved on all those issues. The judgment was entered before the February order. The reason that's important is related to your question, Judge Hall, of what would happen if the stay was lifted. If the stay is lifted, then the acts at that point that are no longer subject to the stay can occur. Here, what Judge Olson said was the stay doesn't apply. So that order is in effect. Now I'm lifting the stay and allowing you to enforce that order. So even if the granting of the stay was for cause, the timeline is still doesn't work for purposes of what the appellee is arguing. The judgment was not entered after the lift stay. So it is not possible that the lift stay would moot it, or even if it's not moot, if that's the wrong legal word, but that it would that it would affect that issue.
Well, so what? So what, Mr. Pogacz? We're reviewing the February 14, 2009
correct
order. That's what we're reviewing. And Judge Olson said the court views as offensive to good faith. I mean, he didn't use the word bad faith, but offensive to good faith means bad faith in the orderly administration of justice, the filing of the petition at the last hours prior to the entry of the final judgment in the divorce case. Do you agree that a decision to lift a stay is discretionary with the bankruptcy court and can only be reversed on a showing of abuse of discretion? Do you disagree with that proposition?
To lift the stay, I agree.
All right. So this decision to lift the stay, the automatic stay, was vested within the sound discretion of the bankruptcy judge. And the judge in this, I mean, he makes it pretty clear in his order that that he's exercising his discretion to prevent your client from using the bankruptcy code to intervene in a state family law matter. That's another, that could be another reason that a bankruptcy judge can exercise his discretion to lift an automatic stay to avoid entanglement in a state family law matter.
I agree.
Our precedent is clear, isn't it?
It would be if this judgment were rendered based on that lift stay. The problem here is that the judgment is entered before that. The judge can't undo that judgment or that stay. So what he says is, so it was inapplicable.
Are you telling me that the February 14 order has no effect?
Oh, no. The effect of that order was that he ruled that because the stay was not applicable, the judgment still was binding. And the issue of law.
How I read the February 14 order.
Your Honor, it would be the only legal way for the prior judgment to be instated. If this was a lift stay, then that means that before this order, the stay was in effect. And if that's the case, then that judgment is void. As a matter of law, it was entered while the stay was in place, and it is void.
You cannot cite a case to support that proposition.
I can, Your Honor. A judgment, and bear with me, I'll pull it up. A judgment that is entered at the time that the stay is in effect is void. I don't believe that would even be a disputed issue. And I'll find the case, Your Honor.
Is it in the brief?
It is cited. It is in the brief, Your Honor, yes.
And could you tell me what, can you cite that case for me?
Yes, sir. Let me just find it. I shuffled my papers because it was.
I don't want to take all your time. If it's in your brief, I'll find the case.
It is, Your Honor, and I'll find it and cite it to you before I conclude.
All right. In that case would support your argument that the February 14, 2019 order has absolutely no effect. It's null and void.
If the stay is in effect at that time, then yes.
Yeah, but I don't know why we can't look at the overall intent of the bankruptcy judge. This seems like a technicality that you're arguing. We can look at the October 2018. You're right, the judgment entered, and you're trying to narrowly lift the stay, say, well, it was only letting the judgment go in as to the bond, the marriage, not as to the division of the property. I don't know. It looks like to me he kind of let the judgment go into effect and said, but I reserve ruling on the effect of the judgment. And then he lift the stay in the February 2019. Or even if you correct, you could read them both together to say the bankruptcy court intention clearly here is to allow the judgment to go into effect and be subject to a lift stay. I mean, you just take the whole ball of wax together.
I understand that, Your Honor. I guess where I'm, the reason I'm pointing this out is because it delineates that what the bankruptcy court was doing with respect to its ruling as to the prior judgment had to be that it was, the stay was inapplicable. There was no other legal way for it to resurrect or make that stay binding. So if we take what your Honor said as correct, then when he lifts the stay as of the date of the February order, that means the stay was in effect before that. And I'm not saying he ruled that. I'm actually saying the opposite. He actually does two things. He says the stay was not applicable, so therefore the judgment sits, and I am lifting the stay and allowing them to go forward and enforce that judgment. So the legal issue that we're appealing here specifically is that the stay was not what was in effect, and there was no exception to the stay applied that the bankruptcy court used retroactively. And Your Honor, my time is definitely up, but the case that says that actions taken while the stay is in place are void and without effect is an 11th Circuit case, Borg Warner Acceptance Corp v. Hall, 685 Fed Second 1306. And so if the judgment were entered previously and the stay were lifted later, then that judgment would still be void and without effect.
Tell me the name of that case again, the site.
Sure. It is Borg Warner Acceptance Corp v. Hall, 685 Fed Second 1306, 11th Circuit, 1982.
And I'll assume that case has nothing to do with the marital situation or anything like that. It's just the general principle. Is that right?
Correct. The general
principle that you're talking about.
Correct.
Okay.
All right. Well, I think we have your argument. Thank you, Mr. Fugach and Mr. Crane.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to argue before you. Mm-hmm.